So it's a real pleasure to introduce Alberto Giugolini from the University of Milan. He's an author of a book on bioethics in Italian and also is published in the very prestigious Journal of Medicine and Philosophy, so I'm sure he knows what he's talking about. And he's going to give us a talk called What is the Problem with Euthanasia? The talk will go for about 40 minutes and then we'll have 20 minutes to half an hour for discussion. So without
okay. Thank you, Steve. Thank you for coming. I have to say that I was a bit surprised when I came to know that there were many people interested in this topic, because euthanasia is a long debated topic in bioethics, and it seems to me that really everything has been said on this topic in the last decade. So I will not say anything particularly original or shocking about this, but I think that despite this state of affairs in the bioethical debate, still there is a lot of confusion when it comes to public debates or to legal debates, and every now and then someone comes out with proposal about euthanasia law, about allowing euthanasia, also recently here in England, but it happened in Australia a few months ago. And well, I think that in this case, in this kind of debates, still there is a lot of confusion on the topic. In particular, it seems to me that when people talk about euthanasia, they fail to keep two questions distinct. One question is, what is euthanasia? And the other question is, why is euthanasia morally problematic? The fact is that often people disagree with each other about the moral status of euthanasia, but they are not actually talking about the same thing, because the label euthanasia is used to cover different kinds of conducts by physicians. So, for example, someone considers euthanasia the situation where in which a doctor withdraws treatments from a terminally ill patient. Some other people consider euthanasia only the case when a doctor actively kills a person. And given this state of affairs, it is very difficult to understand what the ethical problem is, because people actually talk about very different things. I'll give you just one example of this situation. This is a case which we had in Italy a few years ago. I don't know if you ever heard about it. It was very, in many respects, similar to the case of Terry Schiavo in the US. This is the case of Eluana Englaro, who was a girl who was kept in vegetative state for nearly 17 years, only through artificial nutrition and hydration. This was following a car accident he had in 1903. After a few years, her father started asking to have the feeding tubes withdrawn from the daughter, because there was absolutely no hope for recovery. And it took years of legal battles, and finally the request was granted only in 2008, so that the treatments were discontinued, they were withdrawn, and Eluana died on the 9th of February in 2009. Reactions in Italy were very passionate. There were lots of polemic, and in particular by the Catholic Church, as you can imagine, but also by politicians and by other people. So, for example, one reaction was this declaration by the Italian Prime Minister at the time. He was the Italian Prime Minister, who says that withdrawing treatments from Eluana Englaro has a serious implication of euthanasia. So he was using this word, euthanasia, with respect to a situation in which feeding tubes were withdrawn from a person in vegetative state. Another reaction was this one. Recently, in July 2011, members of parliament in Italy proposed a bill. They intended to forbid the withdrawal of artificial nutrition and hydration upon patients' request, but the same bill allows the non-activation or the withdrawal of artificial respirators or other medical devices. So they make this distinction between artificial nutrition and hydration on one side and other kinds of treatment, for example, a respirator. And the reason they provided for this distinction was that they did not want to authorize euthanasia. So these reactions show the confusing situation about the question, what is euthanasia? For example, according to the Italian deputies, withdrawing artificial nutrition amounts to euthanasia, but withdrawing other kinds of medical devices does not amount to euthanasia. So it seems that the distinction between feeding and other kinds of devices is relevant for the definition of euthanasia. But on the other hand, there is no general agreement even among bioethicists, and I will show you in a while some definitions of euthanasia which confirm this, about whether withholding or withdrawing treatments from a patient can be considered euthanasia, in this case passive euthanasia. So there has been a lot of controversy also on the concept of passive euthanasia. And the situation is not much clearer, also surprisingly, in some legislations. So Belgium is one of the few countries in the world who have legislated about euthanasia. The other country is the Netherlands, and also Luxembourg, I think. In the Belgian Act on Euthanasia of 2002, euthanasia is defined as the intentionally terminating life by someone other than the person concerned at the latter's request. So in this case, it seems that distinction active-passive, so between actively killing a patient and withdrawing treatment from the patient, is not so relevant because the word terminating here is specified. So I could terminate the life of a person in many ways, for example, by withdrawing treatment as well as by a lethal injection. So this is one aspect of the problem, of the moral question about euthanasia. The second aspect I mentioned before is that of what aspects of euthanasia raise the moral problem. So it is clear that in order to answer this question, we have first to understand what is the distinguishing feature of euthanasia. So what distinguishes euthanasia from other practices which are considered morally permissible? So for example, we saw before that Italian Prime Minister, by saying that the case of Eluana Englaro had implication of euthanasia, he intended to express a moral condemnation of this practice, but it remains to be explained why the word euthanasia should be taken as equivalent to morally wrong, as many people seem to imply, not only politicians, but also, for example, the Catholic Church. So this is a clear example of how the two issues I mentioned before are often confusingly mixed up. So in the Evangelium Vitae, John Paul II defined euthanasia as the deliberate and morally unacceptable killing of a human person. But the problem is clearly that of understanding in what sense euthanasia can be considered the deliberate and killing of a human person, and why the deliberate killing of a human person should be morally unacceptable. So there are two issues involved here. So what I'm trying to do here is to pick out the distinctive feature of euthanasia. And by distinctive feature, I mean the feature with the different proposed definitions, and I will present some definitions of euthanasia having common, so that my aim is to find a shared definition. I mean a definition which people usually involved in ethical debates can consistently come to agree to. And this is relevant because if we could find such a definition, we could start an authentic debate on ethical debate on the topic, which would replace what currently seems just a cluster of monologues. So we need to think, to talk about one precise object, which is what is not happening now. Okay, so before coming to any ethical discussion, the key question I want to answer is there a definition disputants might come to agree to? So I take this quotation from, again, from Evangelium Vitae. I often quote documents from the Catholic Church, not because I believe these things, but because, as you can imagine, in Italy they are very influential on the public opinion, and I think they are very influential in more subtle ways also outside Italy. Many people think that euthanasia is wrong because there is this cultural background that I think in some way comes from these Catholic views. So if we have a look at the Evangelium Vitae, we find this: euthanasia must be distinguished from the decision to forego so-called aggressive medical treatment. In other words, medical procedures which no longer correspond to the real situation of the patient, either because they are by now disproportionate to any expected results, or because they impose an excessive burden on the patient and his family. So the problem here is that this quotation relies on the fact that some treatments may impose an excessive burden to patient. So in this case, physicians are allowed to withdraw this treatment. But when a pathology imposes an equally excessive burden on the patient or his family, according to the Catholic Church, the doctors are not allowed to take control of death and bring it about before its time. So this expression is taken as equivalent to euthanasia. So it seems here that the distinction between active conducts and passive conducts is relevant for defining what euthanasia actually is. And this is seems to be mirrored also in many medical deontological codes. So this is not just something which the Catholic Church put forward, but also many medical deontological codes have the same, give similar definitions of euthanasia. So, for example, the American Medical Association, in its Code of Medical Ethics, defines euthanasia as the administration of a lethal agent by another person to a patient for the purpose of relieving the patient's intolerable and incurable suffering. So here, euthanasia is the administration of a lethal agent, so a doctor who injects a lethal drug to a patient, for example. This is the British Medical Association, which defines euthanasia as the active and intentional termination of a person's life, so the active aspect of the intervention is still predominant here. And then we have the Australian Medical Association, which defines euthanasia as the act of deliberately ending the life of a patient for the purpose of ending intolerable pain or suffering. So, moreover, the Australian Medical Association excludes from the domain of euthanasia the following practices: so not initiating life-prolonging measures or not continuing life-prolonging measures. So according to the Australian Medical Association, these do not count as euthanasia. So this seems to comply with the commonly held view on euthanasia. I think that every one of us, when I think of euthanasia, have this image in her mind. So a doctor who injects a lethal drug to a patient so that the patient dies painless. But as a matter of fact, there are many definitions of euthanasia which do comprise passive practices. So there is this concept of passive euthanasia which lurks behind many discussions on this topic. So again, Evangelium Vitae, sorry, I think this is the last quotation from Evangelium Vitae, but I think that this is a relevant document for the debate. So it says that in another definition, that euthanasia can be defined as an action or omission which of itself and by intention causes death with the purpose of eliminating all suffering. So they talk now they talk of action or omission. We have here some definitions by some prominent philosophers or bioethicists who hold different positions about the moral status of euthanasia, but they all agree that euthanasia can be either an act or an omission by the physician. So for example, John Keown says that euthanasia is the intentional killing of a patient by act or omission as part of his or her medical care. Michael Green, in his essay dedicated to the definition of euthanasia, puts as a first condition for an act to be considered one of euthanasia the fact that A killed B, so the doctor killed the patient, or let the patient die. We have similar definitions by the Beecham and Davidson, and also by John Harris, who is for euthanasia, but he gives a definition which is similar to that of the Catholic Church or of other philosophers who are against euthanasia. So, according to these definitions, it seems that failing to prolong a patient's life by discontinuing therapies or by withholding treatment can be considered a case of euthanasia. But what does can mean here? So in what circumstances withdrawing treatments is euthanasia, and on what in what circumstances it is not? So if you have another look at this, all these definitions, oh sorry, I'm going to go back. These definitions by many bioethicists and also the definition by the Catholic Church, the aspect which they all have in common is, sorry, is the intention by the physician to bring about death. So Garrard and Wilkinson, in an article on the Journal of Medical Ethics, stress this point. They say that passive conducts can count as passive euthanasia, so they are, can be considered euthanasia if the main purpose of this withdrawing or withholding is to bring about or hasten the patient's death, thus stressing the intentional structure which is essential to euthanasia. So all the definitions provided so far have the intentional aspect as the main point. So it seems that the distinguishing feature of euthanasia is not the fact that a doctor actively kills the patient, but the fact that his conduct is motivated, is justified by his intention to bring about, in any way, either actively or passively, the patient's death. But we don't have to forget that, despite this consideration, the medical deontological codes, they still talk of active practices when they define euthanasia. So, why and in what sense do they tie the meaning of euthanasia on the active conduct of physicians? And so the question arises as to whether they can consistently come to accept the notion of passive euthanasia, so to include the passive aspect into their definition of euthanasia. I think that they can, because I think that the concept of active intervention, as it is used in the medical codes, can be reduced to the concept of intentional, can be interpreted in terms of the intention of the physician to bring about the patient's death. And the reason is that active conduct, active practices, cannot but be performed with the intention to bring about death, whereas passive conduct can be, and sometimes are, outside the domain of euthanasia, because they can be and sometimes are performed without the intention to bring about death. I have two reasons for claiming this. The first reason is that in the case of active euthanasia, so when the physician kills the patient, so the request by the patient is not just that of to have treatments withdrawn, but to be actively killed. So to respect his will means eo ipso to intentionally bring about his death. So the physician cannot claim that he's only respecting the patient's will, because the patient's will is that to be actively killed. But this is not true for the cases where all a patient asks is not to be treated. So if we have a look at this quotation from the American Medical Association, so they say that the principle of patient autonomy requires that physicians respect the decision to forego life-sustaining treatment of a patient who possesses decision-making capacity. But the same principle does not require that the physician respect the decision to be killed, for example, by lethal injection. This is because when, in the case of passive conducts, the presence of a request by the patient allows to distinguish between the intention to bring about death, which is not permitted because it is euthanasia, but also the intention only to respect the patient's will, which is permitted, and therefore it is not euthanasia. Whereas in active conduct, there is no such distinction, because active can only be interpreted as intentionally aimed at killing. And another reason for this is this one, that in the case of active euthanasia, the cause of the death is not the pathology of the patient, but the drug the physician knowingly administers. Therefore, the physician has no ground for denying that his intention is to cause the patient death and for claiming that he just intends to respect the patient decision. But such a claim could instead be put forward in cases where the death is caused by the pathology for which treatments are not activated or withheld. Because it seems odd that a doctor could reasonably claim that, I inject this lethal agent, but I do not intend to kill the patient. So it seems that if a doctor injects a lethal agent, he intends to kill the patient. So it is true that we can have cases where in which a physician withdraws treatments with also the intention to bring about death. But I think that physicians, for example, medical association, the ones I mentioned before, can consistently consider this case one of euthanasia, because the practice in this case is active not with respect to the causal chain between the physician intervention and the patient's death, but rather with respect to the fact that the physician intends to make death occur when by acting differently, it would not have occurred. So whatever conduct is necessary to bring about the death. So this is supported by some quotation which can be found in this medical deontological code. So for example, the Australian Medical Association explicitly states that the AMA believes that medical practitioners should not be involved in interventions that have as their primary intention the ending of a person's life. So here euthanasia, so the practice which is not permitted, as opposed to other practices which are permitted, is based on the intention to ending a person's life and not on the fact that this death is brought about in a passive rather than active way. We find this other interesting concept in the American Medical Association Code of Medical Ethics. So it's the concept of responsibility. So the deontological code of the American Medical Association says that euthanasia is fundamentally incompatible with a physician's role as a healer, would be difficult or impossible to control, and would pose serious societal risks. The physician who performs euthanasia assumes a unique responsibility for the act of ending the patient's life, is the opinion 221. And then they also say that although there is an autonomy interest in directing one's death, this interest does not override consideration of professional responsibility. So it seems like the concept of responsibility as is deployed here is tied on the intention to bring about death and not on the fact that a physician will be available to bring about death actively rather than passively. So I am responsible for something if I intend to bring that something about, and it doesn't really matter the way I bring it about. Another concept which is interesting, which we find in the British Medical Association Code of Ethics, is this one, is the concept of the pressure for ill people. So they say that if euthanasia were an option, there might be pressure for all seriously ill people to consider it, even if they would not otherwise entertain such an idea. Again, the concept of pressure, as it is involved here, has to do more with the fact that there are physicians who have the intention to bring about death. So there are doctors who intentionally help people die and who are therefore disposed to take responsibility for the death, to use the concept which we mentioned before. So it seems that these three concepts which are used by medical deontological codes, so the concept of active killing, concept of responsibility of the physician, and the concept of pressure towards the pressure on terminally ill people, can all be interpreted in terms of intention to bring about death. I think that they all converge to this point. So I think that in the end, according to this analysis, euthanasia can be defined as follows: as a medical conduct, including the conduct of withdrawing or withholding treatments intended at bringing about a patient death, as a means to terminate a patient's unbearable suffering. So this is the definition of euthanasia, which I find more reasonable to hold, and which I think all the parties involved in debate can consistently come to agree to, if we accept the interpretation of the concept of active in terms of intention, as I show now. But once we have defined the euthanasia like this, we have the second problem, so the second core question of the debate. So what is the moral problem with it? So why is euthanasia, why is the intention to bring about a patient death morally problematic? So those who think that euthanasia, so defined, is morally problematic, they usually rely on this distinction between the intention to bring about death and the foresight that death will come about as an unintended but foreseen consequence of physician conduct. So for example, if a physician withdraws treatments from a terminally ill patient, he can claim that he doesn't intend to bring about the patient death. He doesn't want to, for example, respect the patient's will. So, and the death is only a foreseen but not intended consequence. So this position relies on the so-called doctrine of double effect, which is a well-known doctrine, at least among bioethicists and among physicians. And it can be traced back to the Catholic tradition, but it has often been used also by secular philosophers. In roughly stated, it says that a conduct which has a positive effect, such as, for example, the end of suffering, and a negative effect, such as, for example, death, is only permissible if the positive effect is actually intended by the agent and the negative effect is merely foreseen, and the second condition, if the negative effect is not the means through which the good effect is brought about. As I said before, this is not just a position held by the Catholic Church, although I think it dates back to Thomas Aquinas, but it has also been used outside the Catholic tradition. For example, Hans Jonas, he said that to hasten death in this manner as a byproduct of the quite different purpose of making the remainder of a doomed life tolerable is morally right and should be held unimpeachable by law and professional ethics alike, even though it adds another lethal component to the given lethal condition. So this is a quite famous essay by Hans Jonas, even it is quite old now. It is worth noting that this distinction between intended consequences and foreseen consequences was relevant in the juridical outcome of this case, the case of Karen Quinlan in the US. So Karen Quinlan, like Ulan and Glaro, had been in a permanent vegetative state for nearly 1 year. And in 1976, the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled in favor of the parents' request to withdraw the respirator from Karen. This was due to the religious conviction of Karen's father, who was appointed a legal tutor of her daughter. And he was a Roman Catholic, so he thought that withdrawing the respirator was not wrong, because he thought that this act would not be accomplished with the intention to cause Karen's death, but only with the intention to forego disproportionate futile treatments. But it is worth noting that the same principle was not applied to the withdrawal of artificial nutrition and hydration. So the vegetative state of Karen Quinlan went on for, I think, a few years after the withdrawal of the respirator, because the same principle was not applied to withdraw artificial nutrition and hydration, because the father thought that withdrawing artificial nutrition and hydration couldn't but be performed with intention to bring about Karen's death. So we see that the concept of intention here is also relevant to distinguish between what is considered a proportionate treatment and what is considered a disproportionate treatment. For example, the withdrawal of the respirator was considered a disproportionate treatment because withdrawing it does not presuppose the intention to bring about the patient death, whereas artificial nutrition and hydration was considered a proportionate treatment, so something which physicians were not allowed to withdraw, because withdrawing it the intention to bring about the patient death. So also this distinction between proportionate and disproportionate treatment is based in the end on the intention of the physician. So we see that this distinction between intended consequences and foreseen consequences supports the moral distinction, well, what are held as moral distinction, between euthanasia and withdrawing disproportionate treatment, and also the distinction, for example, between euthanasia and terminal sedation. So terminal sedation is the operation through which a physician injects a huge amount of sedative to a person, and the person dies, but the intention of the physician is only to sedate the pain and not to kill the patient. Or at least this is what the physician claims. So the question now is, are such distinction, and in the first instance, the distinction between intention and foresight in the case of euthanasia, morally justified? Well, to argue against the moral relevance of this distinction, it would be enough to find some counterexample, which means some cases in which the fact that a consequence is brought about intentionally or is only foreseen does not make any difference to its moral evaluation. So there is plenty of this example in the bioethical literature. I think that this is the most famous one, is the example of the tactical bomber and the terror bomber, which was described by Jonathan Dennett in the book The Act Itself. So roughly described, so we have two cases. So one is that of the tactical bomber, which is a bomber, a pilot in a war mission, who intends to bomb an enemy's factory. And he foresees that by bombing the factory, he will also cause the death of many civilians. Nonetheless, he decides to bomb the factory. So in this case, his intention is just to destroy the enemy's factory. But as a matter of fact, he also knows that he is going to kill people. And the other case is that of the terror bomber, who is in the same situation as the tactical bomber, but the only difference here is that he bombs the enemy's territory with the intention to kill civilians. So I think that it would be hard to say that there is a moral difference between these two cases, because it seems that in the first case, the fact that the pilot knows that he is going to kill the same number of people actually as the second bomber is not relevant for an ethical assessment. I would say, I don't know if this is an intuition I have or if it is held also by you, but I would say that the two behaviors are equally wrong. And if we apply this consideration to the case of the physician who intends, who brings about unintentionally but knowingly the death of a patient, I think that we see that that distinction is not valid anymore. So the fact that a physician intends to kill a patient, so intends to perform euthanasia, or the fact that the physician only foresees that the death of the patient will come about as an unintended consequence, does not make really any difference to the ethical evaluation of his conduct. So if we think that in some circumstances withholding or withdrawing treatments is morally permitted on the ground that there is no intention to bring about patient death, then according to this counterexample of the tactical bomber, we should also claim that in the same circumstances any kind of bringing about death should be ethically acceptable, because I see no moral difference between intention to bring about death and foresight that death will come about. These examples are quite common in bioethical debates. There are other similar examples, for example, by Philippa Foot or by Francis Camus, which support the same view. But I think it would be unfair to say that the people who go on condemning euthanasia just fail to take this example into consideration, or they even don't know about this example. I think it is we should think that there is some other aspect that we have not taken into account so far, and which accounts for the moral condemnation of euthanasia. So if we think of the definition and of the ethical assessment we saw before, we see that these circumstances in which withholding or withdrawing treatments are permitted on the grounds that they are not performed with intention to bring about death, these circumstances amount to this condition here. So withdrawing or withdrawing treatments is permitted on that ground only in the situation in which the patient is terminally ill, is kept alive only by means of medical treatment, is heavily suffering, is no longer able to appreciate his being alive, is without a reasonable expectation of improving the quality of his life for the short amount of time left to live, and in the end is in a situation in which whatever the conduct of the physician, the patient will die soon. So people who condemn euthanasia but consider the withdrawing of treatment, so consider passive counts permitted, they consider them permitted only when these circumstances apply. When these circumstances, I call C the amount of all these conditions, when these circumstances do not occur, the moral distinctions between permissible bringing about death and euthanasia would not be justified, and bringing about death would always be impermissible. So this is because when this condition does not occur, the physician needs to intentionally bring about death, or to actively bring about death according to the conception of active as implied by medical codes. So the problem here is not with the intention itself, but that intention to bring about death occur when these circumstances occur. Whereas if I see these circumstances occur as a necessary condition for the death to come about soon, so if we are in the condition in which the patient would die anyway, so the physician can merely intend to grant the patient's request or to sedate the patient's pain, and the wished death of the patient will occur by itself naturally. So when these circumstances occur, the physician does not need to intend to bring about death, because death is going to happen anyway. So intentionality, which characterizes euthanasia, can in the end be interpreted in terms of those conditions. So basically, intentionality is problematic because the patient is not in the situation in which he will die anyway. So basically, the patient would die anyway, even if the doctors didn't kill him. So all this means that to ask whether euthanasia is morally permissible is to ask whether is it morally permissible to decide that an event will occur in circumstances in which the occurrence of that event will be evaluated positively, should it happen by itself or naturally, without the physician intervention. But this means that there is a difference in the evaluation of the events according to whether they occur by themselves or whether they are brought about by human intervention. But to hold such a position means to hold that morality has more to do with the recognition and acceptance of what simply occurs as a matter of fact than with a reflection on how to relieve people's pain. But holding this position, I think that this means a failing to recognize that what simply occurs, including dying, often entails more suffering than would be the case if we only did something to reduce it, so to reduce the suffering. Something like, for example, euthanizing people. So the problem is that this is what we always do in many circumstances. We always change the course of nature in order to reduce the suffering of people. And so why shouldn't we do it with euthanasia? So I think that this is implied that we should shift the burden of proof on those who hold that euthanasia is morally impermissible. So we often do this. We often intervene. We often change the course of events, the course of nature, in order to relieve pain and to improve the quality of life, or in this case, the quality of dying of people. So why shouldn't we do it in the case of euthanasia, when a person is dying? So I think that unless a person provides me with a good reason not to do this, and I think that in this presentation I have found no good reasons, because we saw that intention to bring about death is not morally relevant, and that the fact that the patient will die anyway is not morally relevant. So unless there is some other good reason which I cannot find, I think that we should consider euthanasia as morally permissible. I don't know if there are any other objection to it, but I really cannot find a reason why it is me who have to show people that euthanasia is morally permissible rather than vice versa. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Question.
I was just wondering, so you have this list of circumstances that, as I understood it, you thought were crucial, right?
Yeah, so.
And then very much in the beginning, you mentioned this case in Italy of Eulina Anglaro.
Eulina Anglaro, yeah.
Yeah, so then if I look at heavily suffering, is there heavily suffering, perhaps if a person, you know, has probably, that's of course debatable, in a vegetative state, doesn't have any, is not a person anymore, perhaps doesn't even experience, so is there heavily suffering? And the last one was whatever conduct of physician, patient will soon die anyway. I guess it depends on whether you say someone is really dying, if it's perhaps no longer a person in the vegetative state, but it seems in this case that she was already in that state for 17 years, and she might have continued being in that state for 17 years, so it's not like she's going to die soon anyway. Or
yeah, but well, the concept of life we are deploying here is, we need to clarify this concept, because a person in a vegetative state, you might consider her alive in a biological sense,
mm-hmm.
but she's not alive in a biographical sense. So,
but that's considering that, I mean, those cases about that sort of patient are often under discussion, right? And even whether in all those debates about euthanasia, so that it is essential to those conditions, to add a condition that the patient in question has fully conscious or is still a person, or, and then...
Yes, but if we move to the moral level, I think that you cannot consider a person in vegetative state as alive. You cannot even consider her terminally ill, because she's not terminally ill. But from a moral point of view, a person in vegetative state is already dead.
But still, people are heavily debating that, so it's sort of a different sort of case that's not covered by
the
account.
The fact that people are debating it doesn't mean that we should consider a person in vegetative state as alive. Because, of course, people are debating it. For example, the Catholic Church doesn't think that a person in vegetative state is alive, but this does not mean that the issue is controversial. So, as a matter of fact, the person is not alive if we talk from a moral point of view. The person is biologically alive, but it's not more alive than a fetus, for example, but you are not against abortion because of this. Although many people are against abortion on this basis, but you have to provide me with a reason for this. It is not me who will provide you with reasons. So you consider a person in an individual in vegetative state as a person who can be considered alive from a moral point of view?
Okay,
I don't think so, but I
think we should move on. Alex.
Thanks. I think there's some clarifications about the analogy with the bomber's case. So, on the one hand, you have the tactical bomber who wants to harm the enemy camp in a war, and the in order to do this, he targets a factory and foresees the deaths of a number of civilians as a result. And I wasn't sure about the motives of the terrorist bomber. So the terrorist bomber, you said, is someone who targets civilians directly. But I wasn't sure exactly what his motive was, and I think this would influence my judgment as to whether he was
okay.
Or not.
Okay, so that's an important point. I left it out of the slides, but I should have put it. So in the example, as it is presented by Bennett, so they both share the same purpose. So they both want to put an end to the war, but the first, the tactical bomber thinks that he can put an end to the war by bombing the factory, and this will lower the enemy's morale. So this will put an end to the war. And the terror bomber has the same purpose. So he wants to put an end to the war, and he thinks that by killing civilians, he will put an end to the war because this will lower the enemy's morale. So they have the same purpose. This is, you're right, this is an important, this is an essential point in that example. Yeah. So the situation is the same. The only thing which changes is the intention of the two people.
I'd like to go a little bit further in your speech. You're talking about euthanasia in a set of circumstances, for example, unbearable suffering, pain, end of life, people that is paralyzed from the neck to the bottom. Let's think a little bit like almost like a mental experience. If I want to die, not because I have some disease, but I feel miserable, I don't have depression. But I do want to die. Is it possible, in your point of view, it's more defensible that I could ask a physician to help me to die and save my organs to the nation, for example? I mean, is it possible to have an euthanasia without the set of circumstances that we are usually having in this case?
Yeah, I've talked about ill people, but yes, so. Yeah, it is the same point as before. I think this is permissible. I think this should be legal. But is it me who has to provide you with a justification for this being permissible? Or is it you who has to provide me with a reason why this shouldn't be permissible? I think this is permissible. It follows from what I said that this is permissible. A person should be allowed to ask to be helped to die, to be killed, regardless of what his condition is. Provided that he's not, he has no depression, for example. Okay, that's a particular case. So it's similar to the case of anorexia, for example. So a person, you might say that a person is free to ask not to be fed because of anorexia, but that is a pathology. So in that case, you need to cure that pathology. It's a psychological pathology. But if a person is not depressed, it has no particular circumstances like that, I see no problem with this.
Charles, thank you for your presentation. I have one quick point about persistent vegetative state. They have now been done two studies that have shown that persons in a persistent vegetative state can actually have different parts of their brain light up if you ask them certain kinds of questions. So maybe you're familiar with the studies.
Yeah.
So it's difficult for me to understand how we could say that the person is, or the individual is biologically but not biographically alive if they're responding to questions in their brain. Second, I was with you almost all the way until the discussion of the tactical bomber and the terror bomb, because my intuition is precisely the opposite of yours. I do think there's an important difference between the two. Let me see if this helps. Suppose that both bombers were mistaken, and instead of civilians, they were actually dummies set up by whoever was trying to defend this institution or building in order to dissuade people from bombing it, right? So dummies set up to look like civilians. It seems like the tactical bomber could perform his action perfectly well because his intention has nothing to do with killing civilians. He can still bomb and kill and do what he wants to do without killing any civilians at all, whereas the terror bomber cannot because the terror bomber is trying to kill civilians as the end of his act, or at least the means to the end of his act.
Yeah.
And I think that helpfully illustrates why there's an important difference between those two examples.
Yeah, but in this case, you are changing the example in such a way that you cannot compare it to the case of euthanasia anymore. So that example is constructed in such a way that you can compare it to the case of euthanasia. But if you add that aspect, it's not comparable anymore, because in the case of euthanasia, there is no such a third choice. So either the patient dies or the patient goes on suffering. And this is the same situation which the terror and the tactical bomber find themselves in. So
let me try. So suppose I'm a doctor and I give a certain amount of pain medication with the intention to kill the patient.
Without or with, sorry?
With the intention to kill the patient. And I'm a doctor, I give exactly the same amount of pain medication with the intention to relieve suffering and foresee that the patient will die as a result. But suppose both are wrong, right? They don't give, this is not in fact the right dosage to kill the patient. The first physician can't accomplish her end, right? Her end is to kill. The second physician can't accomplish her end because even though she thought she was going to kill the patient by doing this, she ends up not killing it, but she did accomplish the end of her act, which was to kill the pain, not the patient.
Mm. Okay, but so you see a moral difference in this?
Yeah, because both went in thinking that they were going to die, they were going to cause death. One intended to, the other didn't. But then they're mistaken about it, just like they were mistaken about the dummies, right, in the other one. So I see the fact that the latter scenario, they can always accomplish the end of their act, but those who aim at death can't accomplish the end of their act, means that double effect has an important role to play.
Mm. Well, to be honest, I'm not sure I get this distinction.
We can talk later about it.
Yes, but from the point of view of the physician, it doesn't make a difference. So something occurs at a later stage which changes the situation, but from the point of view of the conduct of the physician, this doesn't make any difference. So then the situation changes, and then okay, we can assess that differently. But if we judge it, if we ask, was the physician wrong? Did he act wrongly? I think that the answer is the same in both cases.
That's, like you helpfully showed at the beginning, those are two separate questions. Defining what's going on and then deciding whether it's morally wrong or not are two separate things. I'm just trying to talk about whether double effect and intention helpfully add anything to the scenario.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure that the situation changed. The moral judgment changes. The moral judgment about the physician behavior. So
yeah, that's a separate question.
Yeah. As for your first question about people in vegetative state, yes, there are studies showing that people are responsive. There are some brain activity going on, but I think this is far from showing that there is a biographical life in them.
So maybe we're not talking about the same studies. I'll just say this and we can move on. But the questions that they asked them were,
a person.
Imagine you're playing tennis and the motor part of their brain lights up. Imagine you're sitting in your house, that part of the brain lights up. And they say, imagine that yes is playing tennis and no is sitting in your house reading, and ask them yes or no questions that only they would know the answer.
Yeah, I know this, but I think that these kind of studies are overestimated. They don't really show what people want them to say, because people are responsive to external stimulus, okay, stimuli, but this doesn't mean that they have a biographical life, that they enjoy being alive, that they take advantage of being alive just because they are responsive to something. I think that there is an overestimation of this kind of studies.
Okay, let's move on, Roger. I agree with everything you said. I just wanted to ask a question about the burden of proof at the end. Because I can imagine an opponent of euthanasia saying they can come up with an argument to cancel your argument, right? So the way your argument works is to say, look, there's no difference really between letting somebody die and killing them, in that both bring about a desirable state of affairs. The desirable state of affairs is the relief of pain, and it's the same in both. The burden of proof is on the person who thinks there is a difference. But if you focus on the way those states of affairs are brought about, then there is a difference, and one of them involves killing. And in many cases, we're inclined to think that killing another person is wrong. What? Usually, when human beings kill one another, we think it's wrong. So the burden of proof is really on you as much as it's on the
opponent. But why do we usually think that killing a person is wrong? I think that basically it is because that person doesn't want to be killed, which is not the case when we talk about voluntary euthanasia.
Yes, I think the opponents can disagree with that.
Yes, but why killing? I could ask you why killing is wrong.
You haven't really answered my point, because my point was to do with the burden of proof.
Yeah. Okay, so. Yes, but if you say that because people think that killing is wrong, then the burden of proof is on me. I cannot accept this, because a person could say anything, and a person could say that God exists, for example, and it seems that it is on me to show that this is not true. It is on him to show me that this is true. So, and the same goes with the statement that killing is wrong.
Okay, I've got a question. So, early on you came up with various definitions of euthanasia, and I didn't really like it. And part of the problem was they all seemed to focus on alleviating suffering and blah, blah, blah. And I wondered about this sort of scenario. Suppose I'm actually having a pretty good life, but I believe, for religious reasons, that the afterlife is fantastic, and I just can't wait. Right? I just can't wait for the afterlife. Why should I wait? So what I really want is for the doctor to help me to get there faster. No suffering going on at all, except maybe the suffering of anticipation. So if I were to persuade a doctor to help me die, I think that would be euthanasia. But it doesn't seem to fit within any of those definitions.
So, okay. Well, the concept of suffering, maybe. In a sense, you are suffering from the fact that you are not already in heaven or wherever. So you are in a condition in which you would be better off dead. And this is the same condition in which people who suffer find themselves.
Why your belief is connected to suffering? That's the point.
Well, I mean, you're trying to kind of relativize this by suggesting that because I'd be in a better situation, I'm suffering. But that doesn't seem to be what we normally mean by suffering. I'm reasonably happy, but could be happier. We don't say I'm suffering.
Okay, but if you're not really suffering, I don't think that you would ask a doctor to kill you. So
you
say that you can't wait.
So I would. Or maybe I'm in one of the sort of, I'm in the Heaven's Gate cult, right? And I believe that if I don't die now, I'm going to miss out on eternal happiness. Basically, there was this cult, they all killed themselves at a certain time because they, for various complicated reasons, they either had to die then or they wouldn't get eternal happiness. So maybe I'm in that cult, but I just want a doctor to kill me rather than the other cult members, so it's done properly.
Yeah. Well, still, again, I would say that if you believe in this to the extent that you are disposed to go to a doctor and ask to be killed, this means that you are in some way suffering. Otherwise, there will be no problem for you to wait until
that. I'm having a great time. I'm really having
so
a good
if you
time,
have a great time, you.
I want to make sure I have an afterlife.
Yeah. Okay. So the question is whether I would consider it.
Euthanasia, yes.
If I would consider euthanasia, yes, of course, this is euthanasia. And you say, okay, the person is not suffering. But I find it difficult to see how a person who asks a doctor to be killed for whatever reason is not, to a certain extent, suffering. All the same.
Oh, it's unusual.
Yes, but okay. First of all, I will send you to a psychologist if you put forward such a request because of your religious belief. But if you ask this a doctor, I think that it means that you are suffering because the condition for you is unbearable.
Okay, we've got a question in the back.
Yeah, I was just going to say, with under those circumstances, I want to fast track the verdict gates, you know, or just pulling out. Surely you wouldn't be able to forgive them because they wouldn't be able to sort of sound state of mind. You'd have to be fairly deluded.
It just sounds questioning. I mean, you know, a lot of people believe this sort of stuff, but I don't see why we just turn around and say they believe it.
I'm not saying that. Can we take an entirely different situation then? How about somebody who is aware that he or she is failing and does not wish to be a burden upon their family? Which is, you know, there's no suffering there, maybe. They're just aware that things are not going to get any better. And there's a reason that the thing that might be suffering is not wishing to be a burden.
Presumably this really happens.
Yeah.
But I think that's what the person pretends they're suffering, so they get the doctor to help them out.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about this?
Well, this is a typical objection to euthanasia. It's sort of slippery slope argument. So if you legalize euthanasia, people will be pushed to ask for that if they feel to be a burden. So the question is whether this is an argument, this is a good enough argument against euthanasia. Or the question is whether, if a person has these, on these grounds.
I'm just trying to think of a situation which doesn't actually involve their suffering, but it's more realistic than the hurt-fold case. Something I really could see happening.
Yeah.
So,
I'm
going to call that
imagination.
Suppose I raise a devastating objection to your argument while foreseeing that it might make you depressed. Are you doing anything wrong?
Sorry, can you repeat this?
Suppose I raise a devastating objection to your argument while foreseeing that it might make you depressed. Mm-hmm. Would I be doing anything wrong?
Objection is silent.
No. Okay, so, alright, I'm not going to do that, but
yeah.
But suppose instead I raise a devastating objection to your argument just to make you depressed. Are you seriously going to claim I'm not doing anything wrong?
Yes. That's interesting. I would focus on the argument, not on the intention you put forward. So if a good argument exists, I should face it anyway, so it doesn't really matter what your intention is.
But my intention might matter to the wrongness or rightness of my action. So it might be a good thing that I give you the best case argument, arguably. But you should separate that from whether I act well, whether I act wrongly or rightly in giving it.
But if in the first example you foresee that I will get depressed, I don't see any difference.
Well,
that.
I foresee that you might get depressed.
Yeah.
And
okay.
In the second case,
you intend
trying to be depressed.
I don't see any difference. I don't know, but this is, I don't know if this is just a matter of my intuition. Or if this chair, I really don't see a difference. You see a difference in this? On what grounds? I think it's just a matter of your intuition against my case.
Well, certainly there's something wrong with my character in the second case, at least.
Yeah, but then the question arises whether your character is a morally relevant feature for the assessment of the conduct. So the character of the physician is not relevant for the assessment of his conduct, provided that the same outcomes. About.
Perhaps the difference could be that with that one you foresee that you might be depressed, but with the terrorist who foresees that they will be killed, that it's
because of the bombing the factory that he's actually doing bombing. It's a side effect that he knows will happen.
Yeah. And the same as in the
whereas with the depression, he doesn't know you'll get depression, it's just a possibility.
Yeah.
So it's quite, like, not quite so morally wrong. Mm.
Yeah. Yes, this could be, but in the case of euthanasia, you know that the patient will die.
Yeah, so that's why there's less of a moral distinction between
the case of, in the case of the terror bomber, he knows.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, so I think we're going to make this the last question.
Oh, well, I couldn't put anyone else to take it.
No, you
still mature on what I want to say.
Well, clarify it now. We've got to worry about all the good things.
It was just a... I was just thinking a bit of your example, which seemed to be, to me, to be so different from these euthanasia cases. Like your example, and then someone mentioned assisted suicide, and so I guess I was just wondering about that, and if that, and indeed there's not really a difference, and if it's not essential for euthanasia somehow that I don't know, the patient really needs this doctor to something. I could just say to you, like, okay, so there's a train rail over there, just go and take care of it yourself. Or, but isn't that the problem with many of those euthanasia cases, that those patients have no ability to take matters in their own hands because they can't even get out of bed, or they can't get to the pharmacist to get those pills themselves, or they don't have the physical strength anymore to throw themselves. But I wasn't sure if I should bring this up because I'm not even clear myself what my question is or what the relevance is.
So
they're advocating that they throw themselves out of the train rather than
so
giving doctors the help.
The point here is about the alleged duty of the physician to consider the request by the patient. So you say, okay, the patient to go and kill himself. So
but would you say that there is something as assisted suicide and that it's something different from euthanasia?
Yeah, okay. That was
so, but what makes that difference then?
Well, in many cases of euthanasia, the patient is not able to commit suicide. So that would be unfair. If the patient is not able to kill himself, he cannot. But if the patient
is there a moral difference
between assisted suicide and euthanasia?
Yes, according to you.
Something
that you could, the distinction you could make based on your account?
No, I don't think there is a moral difference. Assisted suicide is euthanasia performed on yourself. So.
Is an empirical difference?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's different empirically, but if you talk about the moral point of view, I see no difference at all.
Okay.